One of the most essential elements in the religious life is faith. And faith is essential also for peace, for harmony within one's own being. Let us inquire, what is faith? If we look at the dictionary, we will find that faith, to have faith means to have confidence in, to have trust. And we will find also the meaning which is held by the majority of people in the world, that faith is belief. You believe in this or that or the other, as the case may be. Belief, faith, you have faith. Now, is this really the case? Is belief a good word for faith? I'm going to suggest that faith is something which is intensely real, but which we cannot define. Faith is not something limited, something particular, something which you can recognize in a commonplace way. A belief, a belief is something which is definite. It's an idea. It has a definite verbal shape. But faith is a faculty which we possess. We can see the manifestations of that faculty, but the faculty in itself is something which eludes us. Take this question of belief being understood as faith. People's minds are full of beliefs. But we will find that those beliefs are obstructions to this faculty of faith. They actually are obstructions. Because a belief is a rigid thing, a set thing. It's fixed. Whereas faith, like life, continuously flows freely. It continuously wells up from within the living being. It isn't fixed. I would go further and suggest an equation like we have in mathematics. Faith full equals belief empty. The person who is empty of beliefs, mere beliefs, is the person who can exercise the faculty of faith. How then is faith born, so to say? How is this faculty which lies dormant within us brought to life? (Clears throat) consider how a belief arises. From the time we are born, we are conditioned. We are told things by our parents, by our teachers, by our friends, those who are near us, around us. We read, we study, and all the rest of it. And this conditions the mind. And we accept what is said, or what is written, which we have read, as true. But that which is said is a fixed form. That which is written is a fixed form. Once my own mind, to a certain extent, has grasped that form, then it fixes it and says, ah, that's that. And the tendency is not to change that, apart from growing along the same lines. So you see, a belief is something which remains fixed. It isn't flexible. It stands in the way. Now, by contrast with that, which is the product of conditioning, of a superficial examination, experience, understanding. If by paying complete attention, we become aware of the whole truth of that which we are attending to, then we have no beliefs about it. We know that that is so. There is an of course-ness about it. This is faith. It is a faculty which one can exercise always. If we don't pay full attention, we cannot have faith. We will only get a limited picture, and we will cling to that picture as, oh, this is the truth, this is the fact, I believe this. This is not to suggest that all our beliefs are false, not at all. A great many of our beliefs are more or less true. But they tend to be rather less true than more true, so to say. And they act as obstructions because we are always loath to alter our beliefs. That is to say, to alter the verbal structure of our experience. What we have experienced, what we have read or studied, there's a verbal structure there, and we want that fixed. Why? Because we are fearful of change. We want security. And we have this peculiar, misleading belief that that which is fixed is safe. It's not an altogether false belief. If you want to build a house, you do want a solid foundation, and preferably upon rocky soil rather than upon clay soil or quicksand. That is true in that context. But in the context of mind and the life and one's own inner life, which is a continuously growing thing, you don't want obstructions. Your tree is rooted in the solid earth, and the roots go down a certain way and fulfill their function, but the tree grows out freely into space where the only resistance usually is the air around. Well, now the resistance of the air is very much less than the resistance of the solid earth. See how growth takes place. So now, faithful equals belief empty. But the question will arise that in life your faith is bound to express itself in various forms, which will include ideas, thoughts, mental forms, which means therefore words to express the faith. And we commonly, and not unjustifiably, because our language is made that way and the dictionary meaning is that, we will have so many beliefs. Now those beliefs can correspond with our faith. But if it is a true faith, the person will always be ready to scrap the belief, which is a particular verbal form, in the face of the evidence, the new evidence which has accrued, and set up a new verbal structure. Of course, everybody else says, or other people around will say, oh, well, you know, this man, he's quite unpredictable. Today he believes this, tomorrow he believes that. Yes, of course. How else can there be progress? Provided the changeover to another formal expression of your faith is not a mere wanton change, that is the point. It is not mere fickleness, but it is the result of actually seeing deeper into reality. Then you have another belief to express your faith. But faith is this faculty which is associated with the seeing of truth. Now, one may ask, in that case, how is faith different from knowledge? Anybody quite legitimately will say, what you are really talking of is knowledge, true knowledge. Yes. But faith has a different undertone to knowledge from pure knowledge as such. Faith has the very deep and powerful element of allegiance. There is allegiance to place trust in, to place confidence in, also means to give your allegiance. He whom you trust trusts you in turn. It is a mutual interplay between the two. If there isn't a mutual interplay, well, it isn't real trust or confidence, is it, if it's one-sided? It has to be a mutual thing. So the element of allegiance comes in where faith is concerned. To what do we give our allegiance, then, where faith is concerned in differentiating it from knowledge? We give our allegiance to truth. The undefined truth, that power, that quality, that mysterious unknown which we name truth in the religious context, which means in the transcendent context. This is a very important aspect of faith, this allegiance to truth. If we want to use a theistic term, and instead of truth, say God, we give our allegiance to God. But note carefully, faith in God, allegiance to God, means to God and not my picture of God. This is the difference. God I don't know. The pictures I know, they are merely things floating about in my brain cells. See, one must realize that. That is why I said right at the beginning, faith is a faculty which we have. It is also strictly speaking, indefinable. Real faith. This power of allegiance. Now there's another thing. If we have real faith, there will be the reality of love for the truth. The love for, if you again want the theistic word, for God. Because unless one cares for the truth, then you can't give your allegiance to it. Your allegiance is a superficial, nominal thing. There isn't any heart in it. If faith is to be a power in life, a real transforming power, then it must have this vital, creative love all the time associated with it, this real caring for it. A caring, therefore, which is irrespective of the consequence in terms of pleasure and or pain, which may come to us through truth, through God. Those whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, says the Old Testament, quite rightly. What is the meaning of chasteneth? To chasten. You take your really great craftsman. When he perfects the thing that he's making, he's chastening it, we say. You see? Really finishing it off, polishing it, making it perfect, wonderful. And in that sense, truth chastens us. But we, getting preoccupied with our pleasure-pain mechanism, we think of it in terms of pleasure or pain, which is a mistake. That is the process of perfecting. You take your ballet dancer. He or she practices, and to me, a common layman looking on would say, oh my goodness, isn't that awful? Must be hurting his muscle or his body terribly. And sometimes it does, doesn't it? But it's all part of the story. Growing pains, as we call them. Every one of us has experienced growing pains when our teeth first came and all the rest of it. So there is always this chastening process going on in the person who has real faith. But the faith must be this allegiance to and caring for that which is the unknown, the undefined. And there must be faith without any desire attached, any wanting a result. The moment we want a result, we have lost faith. The allegiance, the faith, may demand, may necessitate, in one's special circumstance, the supreme sacrifice. Are we going to bargain that it shall not be thus and thus? I'll be faithful to you, provided. Do I love, honor, and obey, or cooperate with you only as long as you do the same to me? Why, then I'm of the world worldly, am I not? I'm just a bargainer. There is neither love, nor honor, nor cooperation there. That belongs to the seesaw realm of buying and selling. That's all, nothing else. It has to be absolute, complete. It has to be transcendental. Then it becomes a true ethic of life, this faith. And it becomes a guiding power for the conduct of life in everyday affairs. See, this is a point which we rarely consider. If our faith is a true faith, our conduct of life every day will be governed by a transcendental ethic, an absolute ethic. What do we ordinarily do? Oh, well, you see, under these circumstances, I better do so and so. How do I come to the decision, I better do so and so? I am compromising, I am balancing up, I am weighing things. And what is my criterion for the balancing up and weighing? The pleasure-pain principle at work. Now, this is what makes the religious life supremely difficult. When we appreciate these implications of the religious life, we will also appreciate why in India they called the one who finally did live the pure religious life the victor, the conqueror. Sanskrit word is jina, jina, J-I-N-A. He who had overcome all his foes. See, the Buddha, for example, definitely says that, I have overcome all evil things. Jesus said, I have overcome the world. What did he mean by the world? Not the objective world of trees and flowers and people and all the rest of it, but this worldliness, this which drags down man to the level of bestiality. I won't say to the level of the beast, because the beast as an animal is a fine thing. There's nothing wrong with an animal. It's only a man who can be animalish or bestial in that derogatory sense of the words animalish and bestial. Every beast as such, nature's beast, is a good beast, and every animal as such is a good animal. It's only man who can do the evil thing. So you see, this business of faith, where it has led us. Do we have faith in the transcendent, in truth, in God, in reality? Tie this up with the inquiry, what makes me turn to religion? Always ask that question. Why do I get interested in religion? Why do I turn to it? Ask the other question. Why did I not be so interested and concerned with religion in the days when I was young and things were going with a swing and everything was fine and happy and so on? We were having a swinging time then. Like they say, modern Britain is swinging along. You see how symbolic it is? The whole thing. Look at the way people live, behave. Swinging along, having a jolly good time. and look at the smile and listen to the laughter of the people. And the light of life in the eyes of people is dimmed. This is the tragedy, isn't it? Dimmed not simply because of illness or sorrow or tragedy in the real sense, but dimmed through listlessness, ennui, no zest in life, in reality. Just a false external noise and fury, a tinsel shape. The real joy of life is not there. Because the real joy of life doesn't need pursuing. It doesn't need any organizing. It doesn't need any effort to hold it, to produce it, to rush about giving it to others. It just wells up from within naturally. Life is joy, provided life is allowed to be spontaneous, is allowed to be true, is allowed to be full of faith. Then there is happiness, inward happiness, which nothing can alter. What room is there for belief? Now, if one speaks to people this way, you may notice they say at once, "Yes, that's very lovely, I'd like to believe it." You see, this just shows how dead all these moving ghosts are, which fill the world. They haven't got the intelligence to say that. That is absolutely the wrong thing. I'd like to believe it. As if their belief would be any help. In fact, it would be a perfect hindrance all the time. This is a really good subject to meditate upon, quietly, by yourself. Faithful equals belief empty. You meditate upon it and see what keeps emerging from within. Now, let us turn to another aspect of it all. An aspect which is tied up with the understanding of truth. We saw that to have faith means also to give allegiance to truth. To transcendental truth. Now the truth in its transcendence excludes nothing. It includes all our petty little half-truths and our untruths. It's a terrible thing to say, isn't it? Truth in its transcendence excludes nothing. It completely includes all our half-truths and our untruths. Look, truth in its transcendence is neither born nor ages nor dies. It is the eternal origin of all those forms and shapes which are supposed to be the expressions of the truth. These forms and shapes are inadequate expressions, temporal, fleeting expressions. They are born, they age, they die. Isn't it a curious thing that in any sphere of knowledge we find a changing expression of what is implicitly believed to be true? All those change. Every one of them changes. You can take the simplest everyday things of life, you can take the sublime things. Take, if you like, the idea of God. And if we go back in history 8-10,000 years and investigate the remnants of the beliefs which primitive peoples held and which we can still find in some parts of the world, some parts of India, in the Pacific Islands and Africa and so forth. Now take that concept of supreme being, supreme power, supreme God, and see how it has changed in the course of a millennia. Undergone tremendous change. Such change that the what we call the most advanced forms of the God conception of today seem to have absolutely no relationship with the primitive forms. Nevertheless, that is what it grew from. And a very important thing to realize is that in a particular age and amongst a particular people, those beliefs are fervently held, tenaciously held, to be the final and absolute truth. Now you see how belief is an evil thing. Because it is this which makes a people war with another in the name of their beliefs. It is this which makes them conceited and separative in relation to others. Take two or three outstanding examples. When Christianity came on the scene, emerged, this was regarded as the final revelation of God. There could be no other. 20 centuries have passed, and the greatest of Christian theologians haven't got the intelligence to see that things change. They say, oh no, this is the final revelation of God. So poor God cannot do anything now for the remaining 2,000 million years or so which are left to us on this planet Earth. He can't give another revelation. Within the first couple of million years, he's done the whole job. What does he do now? It never strikes them, you know. You see how belief makes a man almost an idiot. But isn't this really on a level of idiocy? A simple logic, after all, will show that it's absurd to talk in those terms. What do the Muslims do? They acknowledged Moses, Abraham, Jesus. I should have put the order. Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and Adam also, yes. They acknowledge Adam, Abraham, Moses, Jesus as the great teachers, you see. But of course, Muhammad was the last and he set the final seal upon all. No one after that. Now, is this faith? Or is this incorrigible, inveterate, horrible stupidity? Belief. fixed belief. And look at the terrible wars that have filled the history of Christendom and Islam. Those are two examples. Take another example which has operated in a different way, not so much in terms of wars. If it has operated in terms of wars, which indeed it has historically, only to a minor extent. In India, once the Brahmin caste got established, we are the Brahmins, and all the rest are not the elite. And especially the Shudras, the fourth group, the so-called workers, see, the menial workers, they were regarded as worse than animals practically. And the cruelty through the centuries with which the lives of the Shudras have been afflicted is something incredible. This ordinary human rights and decencies of life which they have been denied because of this Brahmin belief and attitude. It's unbelievable. But there you are. And it was carried out by a caste which claimed to be the repository of the sacred knowledge. And unquestionably, Vedic literature, the Vedas and the Upanishads, are amongst the supreme things in the world of religion. Now you see? They really lacked faith. They had beliefs. They really lacked transcendent truth. So these half-truths and these untruths, because anything which countenances cruelty, oppression and so forth, is really nothing but an untruth altogether, isn't it? All these were the forms which purported to express the transcendent truth of the Upanishads. And yet, the transcendent truth contains all these, it doesn't exclude them. All these bring pain and sorrow to man. And we all learn the hard way. Not through mere perversity. The hard way is one of the unavoidable elements in any exploration into the unknown. I mean, take ordinary geographical exploration, physical exploration. We are going out into the unknown. We don't know what may happen, what may be the difficulties, the dangers, and so forth. And we do suffer. There is one extraordinarily wonderful exception to that. The trip to the moon and back. Completely successfully done. But, look, it was not an exploration into the unknown in anything like the sense. An exploration into some strange land in, say, the depths of the Amazon region is an exploration into the unknown. There it is really unknown, we don't know. But here, our scientific experiments and knowledge was sufficient to tell us exactly what would happen and how it would happen if we launched such and such a project. And it was done successfully. Only in a sense, it was an exploration into the unknown, because the actual surface of the moon had never been trodden by the foot of man, and we didn't know what it was like. There were hazards, of course. One never knows what might have happened when that module landed on the surface of the moon. We didn't know. We took the hazard, we were lucky. And so there. So now, this element of pain, of difficulty, is associated with exploration into the unknown. And in the context of religion, which is the context of the transcendent, of the truth which can never be defined, there is the perpetual hazard. But now this is a perpetual hazard which doesn't bring destruction in its trail. It may bring strain, difficulty, distress, but not destruction. Because there is no such thing as destruction where the mind is concerned. What is there which can be destroyed? You just change your mind, as we say. When you see the truth, you discard the old verbal formulations which you thought represented truth. And that is all there is to it. If we are sensible and intelligent, we are free from all that emotional disturbance which takes place when we discover that what we believed was true is not true. You may remember how some months ago, when I asked, when we started the meeting, what was the consequence of our considerations at the previous meeting? And at the previous meeting, I had pointed out that all that we call Atma, Brahman, God, and the creation of the world as presented in the scriptures is nothing like what we all ordinarily believed. And you remember, one of the members said that it was completely shattering. But she's very intelligent. And she looked far from shattered. But I can quite understand what she meant by saying it was completely shattering. Shattering not because enlightenment shatters the living organism. Not at all. But it is shattering to discover that it is possible to be so completely deluded. And you feel uncertain, you feel unsafe in consequence. That is why. What is the cure for that? To see that there is no such thing like security in truth. Security is a paltry little concept associated just with our worldly life. When we really see that, we will be free and easy. We'll be at home where the transcendent is concerned. Always ready, always willing to undergo the most unimaginable sort of change without batting an eyelid. We can take it, so to say, in our stride quite easily. And what does that imply? Does not that imply freedom? That the mind is free? It's freed of fear? It's freed of bondage to particular beliefs, ideas, conceptions, conclusions? It's freed of all shackles It is empty in the grand sense of the term. And therefore it is pure. It is full of light. Now, let us look a little bit deeper still. It is a commonplace to talk in terms of the light of wisdom, God is light, the enlightened state, the light of the transcendent shines through us unhindered. I use that phrase over and over again, and so forth. Now, all these are words attempting to stimulate the listener to awaken to reality within himself. God, which is light, is a mortal God. God, which is light, is God which has come within human ken. And this is most beautifully expressed. Perhaps it finds its finest expression in the Christian idea of Jesus Christ as the Son of God, the embodiment of God. Christian theology states, quite rightly, God in his own nature we do not know, we cannot see. He is the unknown. But in Jesus Christ, we see God manifest. And through the bulk of Christian literature, especially Christian theological and a good deal of mystical literature, we find God presented as light. But that is the mortal God, God who has come within our ken. But the transcendent in its reality, truth in its reality, is the unknown. It is the dark. The darkness is the eternal reality. But it is a peculiar sort of darkness. It is not the darkness which is ignorance. It is not the darkness which is inanity or death. I think it was a phrase used by Dionysius the Areopagite, and certainly it was used by Milton in Paradise Lost. It is the darkness which is dark with excessive bright, Milton says. Excessive light, says Dionysius the Areopagite. Dark with excessive light. Poetical phrases. But in this case, poetical phrases trying to express the profoundest truth that man can ever know. Consider for a moment some of the implications of such darkness. We've already touched upon one. He's an unwise person who seeks security. Where the deeps of religion are concerned. He is also an unwise person who merely sees this intellectually and therefore accepts with brave resignation insecurity. When he's caught up in the duels. So, to be really at home with this insecurity and therefore be fearless is one of the implications of understanding this darkness. Another important implication. One is completely freed from seeking fulfillment, from seeking the attainment or the achievement of a goal. One really sees fully that all this business of striving to attain a goal is selfness. It is self-oriented. If one has true faith, if one really cares for the ultimate real, it is only that ultimate real which is. I don't achieve or not achieve. The sense of this separate I has been completely seen through, and the separate I-ness is really dissolved at last. This is tremendous liberation. You know how the Buddha said, it's in the Mahavagga, on the night of the liberation, he considers several things, and he says that he who has, it's translated as crushed out. I would rather put it this way, he who has become completely free from that conceit, the I am, the separate I am. This indeed is happiness, this truly is bliss, said the Buddha. And how right he was. See, this seeking to attain a goal is such folly. And when we are freed from it, that which we called the goal, bliss, enlightenment, transcendent love, wisdom, purity, goodness, they are all there. One is just swimming in this ocean of all these transcendent realities. One has to awaken to it, really awaken to it. If one has really awakened to it, what is the sign in everyday life that one really has awakened? It will never go out of mind in the midst of any difficulty, of any stress, of any horror. This will always just suffuse your whole being so much that whilst one is constantly aware of the strain, the stress and all that is happening, this other thing is always shining. It is like the dark the darkness which is dark with excessive bright shining through all this fog of everyday life. Now there's another implication too. One gets free of bothering, oh, did I do the right thing now? Oh, that was not very nicely done. Or one may say, ah, that was a jolly good meeting. Everything went off swimmingly. I'm sure all the people really got full benefit out of it and everyone was happy. All that nonsense disappears. If you live in India, for instance, in the plain lands, where day after day there's a merciless sun shining, beating down upon you, you will start cursing the sunlight and the sunshine. It's intolerable. You live in a climate like this, and if there's a little bit of sunshine, we have nothing else to talk about but that. Now you see, all these extremes just vanish. Because the self has disappeared. The totality is the totality. This no longer obstructs that totality. And this is another source of peace for the individual and harmony. You see, the so-called intelligent, sensible people of the world turn round upon people like ourselves and say, oh, this is all too highfalutin and just too airy-fairy. It just isn't practical. Very good, brother. Carry on with your practical life. Do you object to me carrying on with my life? That's all. Come and have coffee whenever you like. And if you like to discuss, we shall talk together, we shall converse. If not, just as you please. There's no answer to that. There's no real answer. And it is an unwise person who tries to answer that. Because then I believe that I know better, that I am better. And that is the very devil. I have done this myself for so many years. I know what I'm saying. You may recollect, somewhere in the spring or early summer, I said something like this, that he who has really seen makes absolute affirmations of truth, of the truth. The truly wise, the truly enlightened, make absolute affirmations of the truth. The unwise, the foolish, make absolute statements about the truth. There's a vast difference. The absolute affirmations of the truth are either, if they are intellectualist in form, they are paradoxical statements, or they are affirmations of this nature. I and the Father are one. I am the way, the truth, and the life. And so forth. Such statements are it. Or Yajnavalkya's, the Atma is not this, not this, not this. It is unseizable, for it cannot be seized. It is indestructible, for it cannot be destroyed. And so forth. Such statements he makes. And a person listening says, does it need all this solemn assertion? It is unseizable because it cannot be seized? Why, a baby almost, or even a stupid person can understand that if you can't seize a thing, well, of course, it is, the thing is unseizable. What has this man said? All right? Although we are digressing from the main topic, let's consider what this man has said. The Atma. If it is an object of search, a goal to be attained, then the person is constantly trying to seize the Atma with his mind, with his understanding. But the transcendent, the totality, is unseizable by mind or desire or by anything. It is as simple as that, but it takes a very long time. But certainly it took this foolish fellow 50 years before he suddenly stumbled upon it. My God, that's what it means, obviously. We are always seeking goals. Atma, Brahman, God, that's the ultimate desirable goal. Well, you can't grab hold of them. Just can't. It is unseizable. For it can't be seized. See, that's the sort of absolute affirmation of truth which is made by the enlightened, the wise one. The others make absolute statements about the truth. The world celebrates this period, this season. The birth, the time when the Christ was born. And how much has the world realized the significance of this birth of the Christ? How does it celebrate it? Look at its tragic way of celebrating. There are certain nice elements about it, of course. Some very lovely elements, essential elements, elements which make life beautiful, especially family life, and so on. But that is a small part of it. Look at the greater part of it. The keynote of the celebration is self-indulgence. The inordinate indulgence of the appetites, the pleasures. Look at the consequence to the country at large, to the world at large, in terms of illness, of deaths, car accidents, and all the rest of it, and so forth. What is meant by the birth of the Christ? Is it not really the emergence within ourselves of a new awareness? An awareness which emerges and comes to flower because the limitation of selfness has been transcended. How did the Christ life manifest itself through Jesus? Born in a stable, physically, as the legend puts it. He gets lost when he is 12 years of age, preaching in the temple, teaching in the temple. And when his parents and his brethren, his brothers and sisters come anxious, frightened, and speak to him, he merely tells them, apparently heartlessly, "Wist ye not that I am about my father's business?" You see what the Christ does? And his life at home, what a burden, what a thorn in his side that life at home was. His brothers and sisters, do you know how they regarded him? Meshuge, mad, possessed. He was a nuisance. He would probably bring disgrace to the family, do something terrible. That was how they regarded him. It must have been really galling to him to endure that, till finally he leaves home. Just exactly as the Buddha left palace, wife, child. Very interesting contrast. The legendary account of the Buddha's life, all pleasure, all happiness, all marvelous. That's all humbug. I frankly tell the whole Buddhist world that account is humbug. No such person could ever have that something in him which impelled him to go out and become the enlightened one. Quite impossible. He must have gone through hell to do it. No one seeks enlightenment without going through hell. Or seeks God in the real sense without going through hell. And Jesus, the legendary account, is the other way around. Pleasure on the one hand, success and marvelous things. Pain on the other hand, an apparent failure. And then the seeking of the disciples. He calls his disciples to him. The disciples of the Buddha come to him. And when their minds are made pliant and softened, and the Buddha sees, yes, the time is ripe, he gives them the supreme teaching which the Buddhas alone have won, as it is put in the Buddhist scriptures. Persuasion. Here a command. True to the traditions. The Judaic tradition, thou shalt not, so and so, so and so, so and so. Commandments. The Hindu tradition, the Brahmanical tradition, the gentle precept. And therefore no command. No order from the Buddha, come and be my disciple, follow me. No. Jesus says, follow me. Now that is perfectly right according to the whole picture of the evolution of the thing. And then the final climax, the crucifixion. The last sacrifice. The last making sacred. The last breakthrough out of the bonds of all limitation into the utter and complete freedom of the transcendence. God the manifested in the living person, realizing the at-one-ment with God that is the dark. The mysterious unknown, the Father. What an extraordinary thing. It is a picture which is symbolic of the whole universal process. The whole travail of the universe is redeemed by this realization. Just as the whole of dukkha, and we have considered dukkha deeply enough these years, throughout these years, the whole of dukkha is transformed into nirvana by the enlightenment. Now, in our day and age, something new will emerge, has emerged. And it will be utterly different from all that has gone before. That cycle finished with Muhammad. It was a cycle which lasted just over 2,000 years, at least, maybe 2,300 or 400 years. From the Rig Veda to Muhammad is that cycle. And it is all of a piece, like the movements of a great symphony. But that day and age and that consciousness and that world condition has passed away now. And what comes out in this century sets the seal of finishing, of completing on that vast 2,000-year cycle with this 1,400-year interval in between from the death of Muhammad up till now, you see, roughly 1,400-year interval. It sets the seal upon that and gives the impulse for the new. But this new is the child of the old. Every one of us is linked to our primordial source because of the umbilical cord. Isn't that so? There is this invisible umbilical cord. And the source is also the goal. The source is that which is the unknown, the darkness. But the return home is the return in light. Don't make any mistake. It's not the common garden theistic idea of Zarathustrianism, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, that the individual soul enters into a personal fellowship with God forever and ever. These static conceptions forever and ever, oh, the infinite boredom of them. Why people who are otherwise so intelligent should condemn us to that most terrible of torments, the infinite boredom of sameness, is just incredible. Not only ourselves, but dear old God, he's in for it too. They have no faith. Christendom, Hindudom, the Buddhist world, they have no faith. The Judaic world, they have no faith. They have beliefs. They have rigidities. They cling to the corpse. They worship the corpse. When Christendom makes obeisance to the crucified Savior, what does it make obeisance to? The eternal God living and triumphing through that crucified Savior, or to that dead one? That dead one will never come back again. Look at the pathetic belief which obsesses people. It's the same with the Hindus. The Maitreya and the Buddhists. The Buddha named Maitreya will come back, will come again. Kalki avatar will come again. The final Zarathustra, the sociant, as he's called, will come again, and all the rest of it. So they're all sort of waiting with their binoculars, you know. They probably have made all the necessary splashdown arrangements and whatnot, you see, to receive the Lord when he comes. Absolute nonsense, but the Lord is here. If we had faith, we wouldn't merely talk about the omnipresence of God. We merely talk about it. It's a belief, not faith. It is a half-truth, not truth in its transcendence. But if the omnipresence is the reality for us, we have really woken to it, then we would be utterly different. And still, despite all human failures, wonderful things have happened also. There is more enlightenment. There is more love. There is more wisdom in the world and knowledge. Take one simple example, the growth of our social sense and its expressions. Make life far more humane than it ever was in past centuries. This is very definitely one of the expressions of the fruit of the teaching of the great teachers. It is there. And insofar as we as individuals realize truth, and let this tremendous power of faith operate, which will enable transcendent love and wisdom and purity to manifest themselves in life without struggling. Insofar as we do that, we transform the world. We have not, far from having lived in vain, we live immortally, deathlessly, not as separate individuals, but in terms of that infinite life, which is the infinite truth and reality. Infinity is realized. The supreme is realized. The unknown is realized, but never restricted into the common mold of the known. This is the marvel and the beauty, the joy of existence, the zest of life. This is the state of communion. This is the meaning of meditation, of samadhi. Not merely to see it intellectually, not merely to feel it emotionally. These two are there, of course, in the early stage. But then, one sort of emerges out of it. These are like seeds, the intellectual and the emotional. Out of those seeds, there emerge marvelous tree and flower and fruit, which we know nothing about. It's not necessary to know it. It's not necessary. We have the faith.